Hi, everybody, and welcome to the June episode of AZMCast. You know, every year we like to highlight one senior Grand Rounds for a special episode of our June podcast, and we do this for a couple of reasons. One, it highlights the amazing residency program that we have here in Tucson. Two, it honors the amazing outgoing senior class for all of their hard work and dedication. And three, mostly it allows us to go on vacation. But in all seriousness, this year's Senior Grand Rounds was performed, and I do mean performed, by Dr. Carl Youngs. Carl put together a truly epic talk on drugs of abuse, their presentations, their mythos, their street trends, their treatment. And to do this, Carl spent a week in Burning Man, as kind of an anthropologist, so to speak, studying the habits and the rituals of those who use these drugs. And I'm sure it was very difficult for him to be so out of his element in a place like Burning Man, but we commend him nonetheless for doing a stellar job. No peer review, no bells or turkeys this month, just an hour of truly entertaining and truly educational time with the Mad Viking himself, Dr. Carl Youngs, on drugs.
All right, guys, so I'm Carl, one of the senior residents. This is my Grand Rounds here. So, I'm giving a little talk on some recreational drugs. And the reason I decided to do this was a couple reasons. One is, I'll just ask, so here in Tucson, what kind of recreational drugs have you guys seen come into the ER for people complaining of problems?
Spice.
That was really popular last year.
Meth, heroin.
Ecstasy.
You've seen ecstasy?
Yeah.
How many times?
Oh, yeah, there was a shrooms yesterday.
Shrooms? Okay. So you see this spice, this meth, the heroin, those are like the Tucson classics. That's the Tucson triad. That's what's super cheap and that's what's super popular. One ecstasy dose, one LSD, one shrooms. So these other ones that are less common, we really don't see. And so knowing how to treat them can be important because it's things that we don't actually see. So on my vacation, I did my yearly Mecca to Burning Man this year. And I saw a ton of people that were tweaked out on multiple polypharmacy. And these are very interesting people to talk to. Because this is kind of, what's interesting to me is that there's so much falsehood wrapped up in recreational drugs. You ask people questions about, like, what did you take? And they say, like, oh, I'm totally on this particular isomer. You'll get people that use this terminology, like, I'm on an isomer of LSD that was derived in the 1930s. And they're all crazy. They have no idea what they're talking about. So it's very interesting because some of these patients will come in and they'll actually start spouting these things off. And as with most toxicology, it's really difficult to ever tease out exactly what they took unless they told you. And even more so with recreational drugs. So for example, when someone comes in on pill overdose, it can be fairly straightforward if they say, I took 30 tabs of this medication at this dosage at this point in time. It's a very isolated incident. Even if they took 10 different meds, you know the exact dosages. With these recreational drugs, 90% of the time, the people, when they buy it, they have no idea what they've just bought. They're told by some guy that's got 6 beepers and is wearing a do-rag, kind of like a surgeon on call, I guess, that this is what it is. Some of these things are super expensive to manufacture, and so they get cut with other things. So recognizing these clinical syndromes is important. Unfortunately, there's really no specific clinical syndrome for each one of these things, and there's a lot of crossover between all of these. Some of these things have upper effects and downer effects and hallucinogenic effects all at the same time. So the uppers and heroin tends to be what's popular here in Tucson. The spice and the bath salts, that was popular for a while. But can anyone tell me what the active ingredient in spice or bath salts is?
Cathinone,
that's in bath salts. But so you have this like general term, and a lot of these also become this term designer drugs. Does anybody know what designer drugs are? Have you heard the term designer drug? Yes. So designer drug, this is where, basically this is where when you have an economy like today, where you have all these people with chemistry degrees that can't find work, this is what they do. They steal lab supplies and they make designer drugs. Designer drugs are when the DEA says this new drug is going to be now Schedule 1, then these guys take that drug and they add methyl groups or alkyl groups or something to it to where it's no longer that particular substance and it's now legal, but it has the same effect. And they can end up making these drugs through their experimentation thousands of times more potent, or they can have completely different effects. And this will be something where a new strain of ecstasy will get released out and people will have crazy anaphylactic reactions or all kinds of other stuff to it. So we're just going to kind of jump right in here. So the uppers, these almost always present with sympathomimetic syndromes, and they can have associated psychosis. So we've all seen tweaked out meth guy who's, and psychiatry refuses to see them because they're like, no, this is meth-induced psychosis. With psychosis, a lot of these illicit substances, they act on our dopamine, serotonin systems. And so excessive dopamine is what's causing these schizophrenic people to become psychotic. So we all kind of know how a sympathomimetic thing presents. It can vary from just slight agitation, tachycardia, all the way to hypertension, malignant hypertension, and actual stroke. So uppers typically present with dilated pupils, diaphoresis, tachycardia, hypertension, agitation. I saw the worst case of meth washout that I'd ever seen a couple weeks ago. And so this meth washout syndrome is where these guys are usually using repeatedly. They'll use and then they come down, they use again. They'll do this for 48 hours, a week, however much they can get their hands on. And so they're causing systemic release of their own catecholamines. And eventually your adrenals are just gonna burn out. And so when you get to that point, that's when they usually end up in the hospital and they're tweaking, they're freaked out, they're agitated. So you give them a bunch of benzos to calm them down. And now you've got a person that's got no sympathetic response at all, and you've just benzoed them or put them in a K-hole. And so I had a person that I had to actually intubate and put on ventilatory support because of such bad amphetamine washout. So we'll just start with the amphetamines in general. So methamphetamine's really commonly seen in our emergency department. It's typically the smoked methamphetamine version of this pine that's bought on the street, but as with all these things, prescription amphetamines are becoming more and more popular. The season just started. Every year, I think I have more and more patients that are on Adderall. Some of it's prescribed to them, most of it's not. I read one case study a report that there are kids as young as 10 now saying that they're taking Adderall that's not prescribed to them, or they're taking their friend's Ritalin to try and do better in school. So the amphetamine salt, that's the actual Adderall. So if you get a prescription for Adderall, it says amphetamine salt on it. It's straight up legal speed. And then, I won't even try to pronounce that, but Vyvanse. Vyvanse has become this new, really hip drug that the older people are taking. So, I got too many downers with my Vicodin. I need to have some Vyvanse so I can kick it up and focus. Vyvanse was actually very popular at Burning Man. It was something that people would just try and take to expand their horizons, or probably it was just so they can stay up all night to party. So the clinical presentation of amphetamines, overdose, sympathomimetic presentation. This ranges, like I said, from tachycardia, and they can get hypertension so bad that they even end up having strokes, which can confuse their neurological exam because they're already impossibly difficult to get a tweaking patient. And when you say tweaking, let's use the term stereotypy, because you can put that in your note. That's the fancy doctor term for tweaking. That's the myoclonic jerk, the weird itching that they get. So I learned a lot of cool terms when I was making this one. So so some interns might not have seen, you've probably seen a meth, but you might not have managed one yet, but the meth washout is definitely a thing that you got to be careful for with these folks. And so management, so you're going to hear me kind of repeat myself, benzos, this is basically a toxicology problem. So benzos is kind of ideal. You can really never go wrong with benzos. There's pretty much only one overdose that you don't want to give benzos for. Benzos. You guys are so smart. So You're probably mostly familiar with the shelf question or the board question of the cocaine-induced chest pain and tachycardia, how beta blockers are contraindicated. There's actually some current research that shows that that probably doesn't have an effect on amphetamine use, which is interesting. It's only isolated to cocaine. Again, this there was research from 2015 in some lab rats that showed that you don't have to just go straight for an alpha blocker. You could actually safely use beta blockers in these patients. Labetalol has a great track record, though, because it's got combined alpha and beta. Labetalol in cocaine, not necessarily the best, because the beta is typically stronger than the alpha effect. Versed, I love using Versed for these guys because it's longer acting, especially if you use it intramuscularly, you get an even longer effect for them, so your nurse doesn't call you every 10 minutes and saying, yeah, they're still agitated, or they're re-agitating. But again, with that meth washout, you gotta be careful, it's really unpredictable. You can have one person that's up, alert, tweaking, semi-cooperative, and then in 20 minutes they're somnolent and stuporous. So cardiorespiratory monitoring of these guys, especially end-tidal CO2, will give you early clues that they're in some respiratory depression. Cocaine. So we're all probably pretty familiar with this, just because this is like tested all the time in med school and on our board exams. So this is stimulant, acts by inhibiting the reuptake of dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine. So the dopamine and serotonin in the cleft is what gives that high euphoric effect, and the norepinephrine is what gives your sympathomimetic effect as well. So, yeah, and there's, they're finding out all kinds of stuff now about how it actually has some evidence that it acts on the NDMA receptor, or NMDA receptor, which is where ketamine and PCP also act as well. So clinical presentation, again, another classic sympathomimetic: restless, paranoid, agitated. Some things that are somewhat unique to cocaine toxicity is that there can be widening of QRS and QTC because there's a direct cardiotoxic effect causing conduction delays. It was really funny. Out of Burning Man, you'd hear people that would be on opiates and Vyvanse and mushrooms, and I don't do cocaine, that's bad for your heart. They would have a... It's really funny. The circular logic that people use out there is very interesting. So chest pain induced, cocaine-induced chest pain. Again, we all know what that's about. Mainstay of treatment with that is benzodiazepines. And your workup for them typically shouldn't, you know, include all things working up for ACS, even in the 18-year-old that's just tried cocaine for his first time. It can lower seizure threshold. Many of these illicit substances can lower seizure threshold, and a patient that has an undiagnosed seizure disorder, this can be their first presentation. Hypothermia, their weird neurological findings, vision changes, and GI symptoms as well. So this is kind of interesting, that direct cardiotoxic effect. The molecule that's in the cocaine, it actually overstabilizes the myocardium to where it can't actually run, it can no longer run action potentials. And that's what causes them to actually go into cardiac arrest. It's not typical for a patient to have sudden cardiac arrest that's just a casual user. This is more seen in the packers and stuffers, which, you know, Tucson, we're right next to the border. We all see our fair share of packers and stuffers. Young, healthy guy, you know, you can see them too, that Border Patrol brings them in. They're in this sympathomimetic type of situation. This is definitely something that you should keep in mind. So the chronic users, their tolerance, they only get tolerance to the euphoric effect. They don't get tolerance to that cardiotoxicity. That's why it becomes a super dangerous drug when they have to keep dosing higher and higher and higher to get their desired effect, because each time they dose higher, they're putting themselves at risk for having sudden cardiac death. I thought that this was really fascinating. This has a direct negative ionotropic effect. So some patients don't present hypertensive. They can actually be hypotensive and in cardiogenic shock. So they can be super tachycardic and hypotensive because of this transient cardiomyopathy that it actually causes. So for these types of people, it's, you know, in an ideal world, you would recognize that and be like, aha, this is clearly cocaine-induced cardiomyopathy, and you can start on a positive ionotrope like dobutamine. In our world, we're never going to actually know what's going on. Again, like with seizure disorder, the unknown dysrhythmias like WPW can be unmasked by these. We still have patients who have had multiple MIs and come in and still endorse cocaine use. You can't really, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. So patients with known coronary artery disease and heart disease shouldn't really use any stimulants at all. Tobacco products, caffeine, and strong stimulants such as cocaine and meth definitely can precipitate massive MIs. Cocaine users, 14 times more likely over their lifetime to suffer a heart attack or stroke than non-cocaine abusers. Treatment, benzos are king, and like we were saying, you can have hypertension that is refractory, and this requires alpha blockade, calcium channel blocker, or nitroglycerin. The American Heart Association does not recommend one of these drugs over the other. It's one of those general, you can use any of these, and cross your fingers. Cocaine can cause the dysrhythmias with widened QRS because it has sodium channel blockade effects, kind of similar to a tricyclic antidepressant. Sodium bicarb can help close that gap up. Vasopressin was recommended in some studies as being a better first-line pressor for hypotension patients because it doesn't have a direct alpha effect. It doesn't have that. It's not stimulating that same receptor that the cocaine is. You're hitting it from a completely different area. Dobutamine, if you're thinking it's cardiogenic shock as well. Again, treat these like any tachycardic patient if they have any patient with dysrhythmia. Hemodynamically unstable patients definitely require immediate cardioversion. Propofol is actually great for an agitated, hypertensive cocaine overdose patient. You can give it in an aliquot like less than a conscious sedation, or even just give a conscious sedation dose, but be prepared with your airway RSI kit and airway roll. PCP. PCP is kind of a retro drug. Has anybody personally encountered a patient that was on PCP? Oh, you guys are all crazy. So, PCP. Patients will say they're on PCP. They don't necessarily know that they're on PCP. PCP lost favor when ketamine became popular. PCP was developed, actually, so it was used as an anesthetic and then as a NMDA receptor agonist, and ketamine, when it was developed, was found to have a much safer profile, less incidence of post-operative psychosis. So ketamine abuse started to rise and PCP started to drop. However, PCP is apparently super cheap and easy to make. When I was down in San Diego, you could have people offering to sell it to you on the streets because it's apparently super easy to make. The material can be purchased from China online, the raw material, and it can be made in your kitchen with just stuff that you find around the house. So, it's also dissociative, just like ketamine is, and so you get people that can feel massive amounts of pain when they're on it, because they have a dissociative effect from the pain. Lasts a lot longer than ketamine also. So how these guys present. So PCP hallucinogen. So I put it in the stimulant category because you're most likely going to first recognize them as being kind of tweaked out a little bit with that stereotypia, the myoclonic jerks. They got slurred, spread, pressured speech. The mechanism actually acts at muscarinic receptors as well as nicotinic receptors, causing a whole constellation of symptoms. But the nicotinic action causes the myoclonic, the jerks and the tweaks and everything, and the muscle spasm. Catatonia and cataplexy, which means they can be completely asleep and not talking. So basically with this PCP, it depends on where you catch them in their duration of action of the drug. You can get them coming out super tweaked out and hyped up. You can catch them hallucinating. Or you can catch them super somnolent and washed out. Torticollis, and I didn't know tortipelvis is a word. So that's interesting. And these fancy words, obstinatonos and athiatosis, sound like the same thing to me, but that's a classic for PCP. So useful information about PCP. As I said, its relative ease of manufacturing makes it still somewhat popular. It actually, of any drug, it has the highest non-continuation rate. So if you're considering trying it, I probably wouldn't recommend it, because almost everybody who tries it doesn't keep doing it for the rest of their life. And only 0.8% of high school seniors state they've ever tried PCP. That's like lower than any other drug ever. That's amazing. So these awesome, cool names. Zoot. Zoot's one of my... I love that. It's great. Because you walk in on your patient and you're like, what are you on? Angel Dust? Amp? Zoot? Crystal Supergrass? What have you been doing? You'll hear, colloquially, I heard this a lot at Burning Man, people would say, oh yeah, my marijuana cigarette soaked in embalming fluid. I don't know if you guys ever heard that term. It's PCP. It's not embalming fluid. It's not formaldehyde that they're soaking it in. It's actually PCP. So that the marijuana cigarette is called embalming fluid. Pikachu, since all the kids are now into MDMA, you can have MDMA with PCP. It's called Pikachu. Adorable. Bath salts, so as Dr. Beck mentioned, the cathinones, they're derived from the cot plant. So this bath salts and spice I kind of put in the same category, because this is like the definition of a designer drug. This is where these drugs, different isomers of this drug are being made faster than the DEA can investigate and isolate and actually make illegal. This makes it extremely difficult for us, because people have... different people react differently to each one of these, and there's hundreds of different isomers of this out there. They typically present with a sympathomimetic response, and they have associated psychosis with it. They're also structurally similar to the amphetamines. Supportive care is pretty much all that we offer. The duration of action of most of these cathinones tends to be fairly short, but patients tend to redose, and one of the features of the cathinones is that they actually have an increased desire to redose while you're actually high. So methamphetamine, you take it, you feel great, you come down and they redose. Spice users, part of the high is a desire to go out and acquire more spice. So I remember I had a patient that I discharged. It's my first patient of the day. I discharged him like 2 hours in. He walked out of the hospital, got an Uber to a head shop, bought a bunch of spice, smoked it, and passed out in front of the head shop. And I saw him right back in about 2 hours later. Oop, it was. It was definitely continuity of care.
That happens at the gym show every year down in South Campus.
Yeah? Ooh, no, I don't want that.
You see all the packages. Sweet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I didn't put any up. The packaging is awesome, because it's like, it literally will say, like, bath salts for soothing relaxation, and it's these little, like, look like methamphetamine crystals. And they've got all these, like, one of them is like, they talk about, like, delicious potpourri blend, and it's really interesting. The easier that these things are to make, the more people are actually just making them, so... All right, let's go talk about some downers. So, CNS depression can cause, mostly at least, cause death by respiratory depression. It can also cause transient hypertension, and aspiration is a big way that a lot of these people end up dying. So, opioids. Who's not familiar with opioids? Man, this is America's favorite drug. So, opioids, they bind mu and kappa. I don't need to go over all this. You guys know this. But anyway, the peak effects of opioids, this is kind of important to know. 10 minutes with IV, 10 minutes with nasal instillation, which means you crunched your pills up and snorted them, and then 30 minutes with IM and 90 minutes with PO. Those are useful times to know. Also keep in mind that it's metabolized hepatically, so liver patients, you got that person that's got horrible cirrhosis and is chronic liver failure, you give them 4 morphine, it's going to be kicking around for a day. They're going to be fine. When they keep complaining of more medicine, you're going to be overdosing them. It's clinical presentation, stuporous, history is given by the person who found them, and EMS is typically already given Narcan en route. That's kind of the way that we all, that's how most of the time I figure out they're on, was EMS is like, yeah, they weren't breathing when we found them, we gave them to a Narcan, and now they're awake. So CNS depression, bradycardia, and high end tidal CO2, and meiosis. So this was the meiosis, the pinpoint pupils. This is definitely a use caution tool, because you can have people that do polypharmacy. They take uppers and downers all at the same time. So anytime there's clinical uncertainty, you can go ahead and give Narcan if you feel that they're in respiratory depression to a point that you're going to try and prevent them from being intubated. Keep in mind, we throw Narcan around a lot. I've been told, like, EMS's protocol is that for an unconscious person, they always give glucose, Narcan, and oxygen. Narcan has some side effect profile. They're fairly rare, but it can cause flash pulmonary edema, anaphylaxis. It can cause some nasty stuff that, you know, you gave Narcan because you're trying to save this person's life, but you need to be aware of some of the complications of it so that you can reverse those as well.
Carl, do you know the response and the side effects that does come in for Narcan?
Oh, on the opioid?
No, like for flash pulmonary edema.
Yes, I believe it is, yeah. So the higher dose that you take of, that you administer of Narcan, the more likely you're going to get the, but something like anaphylaxis is probably less so, but the pulmonary edema, yeah. And it's not in here, but Narcan, the recommendations are slow titration of Narcan. The current one is anywhere from like 0.2 and start up to a max of 10 milligrams, because nothing will agitate a patient more than just putting them into florid narcotic withdrawal.
It's rate dependent too. If you slam it, more likely to get.
Yeah, I remember reading some of the specific things I was reading was saying a quiet, peaceful sleeping patient in the back of an ambulance can quickly turn into an agitated, combative patient, making the ambulance ride much more difficult. All right, so that's our clinical presentation. Opioids, I kind of glossed over that because we're all pretty familiar with it. Who has heard of kratom before? All right, so I got two people. Okay, so see, we're narrowing down. Okay, so kratom, this is this kind of a new popular drug that people who are trying to, who have chronic pain but don't want to be on opioids are using. So this is an evergreen tree. It's just a leaf, it's a natural leaf that's ground up. You can take it in capsules and brewed in tea as well. I don't know in Arizona, in Nevada, when I was in Burning Man, you can literally walk into any head shop and just buy this in powder or pill form, in capsules. So this is all unregulated right now. The DEA is currently considering putting it on the schedule list, though. So it's supposed to give an analgesic effect with much less euphoria and less respiratory and CNS depression. You talk to some of these people who take it, and they absolutely love it. I met probably 8 or 9 people out at Burning Man that said that they were previous opioid addicts and that kratom helped them entirely get rid of all their opioid addiction. Whether that's got a psychosomatic effect to it or not, because this is all natural, I don't know. But something to be said for that. So talking more about this. Kind of, these will present, there are some case studies of these presenting as respiratory depression, like opioid overdose, because they act similarly on the mu receptor. Unfortunately, the number of people using synthetic prescription opiates is much, much, much higher than people using kratom, so the data is just not very good right now. Narcan theoretically should work since it's on the mu receptor, but there's been some data that's been in guinea pig ileum tract where they've showed that they give high doses of Narcan with kratom present, and it does not alter the way that the kratom is potentiating the receptor. That is kind of frightening, because that means that this could be a new alternative drug that's touted as being much safer, but we don't have a reversal agent for it. So we're going to have to kind of follow this data as it goes out. So a couple case studies of seizures being caused by it, and then can also cause psychosis. So chronic use, liver injury, cholestasis, renal insufficiency. Again, these are all things that are associated with opioids. It's just that you have to be aware of the risk is present. Withdrawal is a noted effect that happens when you stop kratom, as with regular opioids. And 15 deaths have been recorded in the 2 years that it started gaining popularity. But of those 15 deaths, every single one of those had another substance involved. Typically, it was alcohol. Again, this is the numbers that we're looking at don't have the power to give us a really good idea of what's actually happening. If you told me, you know, we could reduce the opioid epidemic down to 15 deaths over 2 years, then if we don't have a reversal agent, that's probably okay, because this overall has a better better outcome. But I don't know the total number of people currently using kratom in the U.S. So, yeah, so last year, this was kind of interesting. The DEA, in August of 2016, announced their intentions to make kratom a Schedule 1. And there was this huge public outcry. And then in October, they withdrew that intention, and they haven't made it Schedule 1. I don't know of any case where the DEA's ever said, we're going to make this illegal, and the public said, we don't want this illegal, and the DEA said, okay. It's weird. So, you can just walk into the store and buy it right now. All right, THC. We're going to see a lot more of this as things progress. So, you could give an entire Grand Rounds talk on THC. We're just going to talk about a little bit of it. Expect to see an increase in it, though, since certain states are legalizing it. You can zip on right on over to California, and you can walk into any shop, any dispensary, and you can buy as much as your little heart desires. This is the most commonly used illicit substance in the world, and it's commonly used with other substances as well. Looking at this, the reason I say you could do a whole Grand Rounds project on this is because trying to find a straight answer on what this stuff actually does to you physically and metabolically is very difficult. This is such a politically charged topic that for every study you find that says this is the greatest thing ever, you find one that says this is the devil and is going to kill you. So it's really difficult to separate through this this stuff. With the legalization of this in certain states, we'll probably see better research coming out in the future. So, yeah, Emily?
Did you come across anything about, like, Arizona's guidelines for... I feel like half my patients have, like, medical marijuana.
The medical marijuana card. So... Arizona is basically, it's still illegal to purchase without a medical marijuana card. Are you aware of the process of getting a medical marijuana card? Okay. I do not have a medical marijuana card, but I discussed with people at Burning Man about their cards, people who had them, because I was curious. So the process to get one is a 15-minute Skype interview with a physician who they you schedule your time. They log up and they say, hello, I'm Dr. So-and-so. Do you have any of the following? And they hold a whiteboard up that says depression, anxiety, glaucoma, belly pain, chronic nausea. And you say, I think I have anxiety. And they say, fantastic. Your card will be in the mail in 2 to 6 weeks. And it shows up. It's like $45 for the session, is what I was told. So it's extremely easy to acquire a card. That's in California. I'm not sure the...
I can answer that question.
Yeah.
So in driving back from a concert from Phoenix, I passed on the highway. There's a store called Botanica. It is the one dispensary for medical marijuana in Arizona. So I got curious. I went on their website. If you go to botanica.us, there is all of the legality for Arizona medical marijuana cards, how you do it, what the process is, how you go to their store, what they have for sale, all that kind of stuff. So if you're interested, you can read it. It's great, like Saturday morning, sitting in bed, finding out the Arizona rules. But the legality in Arizona is a little bit different, so there is a list of conditions. Some of the ones Carl mentioned are not on that list, interestingly. They're actually a little bit more clear.
I think California was probably a little bit more lax.
A little lax.
Yeah, well, now it doesn't matter because you can just walk into a dispensary
right.
there.
But if you want to know about Arizona,
they just sprung up overnight.
That actually like cites all the statutes and everything too. It's actually pretty cool.
Botanica's not the only one though.
They're not, but if you drive on the high, it's got this huge,
yeah,
like, it's very pretty.
It's got honey bees.
And well, so Nevada, they legalized recently, and it was interesting. Colin, have you been back to Reno since?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to run this.
Yeah.
They're, it's weird.
Isn't it strange? Like, because you go to places that we went to, like, hang out in college, and like 10 dispensaries have just literally overnight just popped up, and I went to one just to see what, like, because you're curious about like what happens, and it's like they take
like,
your they
like a boutique bakery.
Yeah, like they take your ID.
Like donuts.
They take your ID.
All in, like, these really elaborate. I mean, they must be making money.
Oh, they are. But it's interesting. So they take your ID and then they buzz you back, the locked door, you go back, and then there's a person there, and there's just all of this stuff, and they're like, so what can I help you with today? And you people are talking about, like, oh, well, I have nausea, and I have this, and it's just some guy that's like, oh, nausea? Oh, you want this one. Absolutely. It was, when I went there, I was just kind of curious, and he's like, oh, let me tell you all about us, and all this. It's interesting, because it's all cash, because it's still federally illegal, so there's all this security and super secure armored stuff there. It's kind of a trip. It's kind of a trip for sure to see.
Age 18 or 21?
18. Is it 21 or 18? Nevada's 21. Nevada's 21. Nevada's 21. So that's. Yeah. So. All right. Well, we digressed, sort of, but not really. So, clinical presentation. Naive users have agitation and paranoia. You will probably see this, some of you. The college kids show up and they try pot for the first time, and they're just like, they have this weird freak out, even acute psychosis. Euphoria and relaxation is common. There's all these kind of other things that come along with it. The toxicity, I wanted to mention that for a minute. How many of you have heard there's never been a recorded case of a marijuana overdose causing death? All right, that's not true. But it's very small. The people that have actually died from it, you can die from a direct toxic dose. It's possible. But the amount is like 1,000 times greater. You'd have to like have a giant pile of it and have a... just light it on fire. I guess. I don't know. I don't know how you would do it. I don't know. But you'd have to ingest like 1,000 times what the average user would use. So also, when you are trying to go by milligram dosages, you can't ask a student how many milligrams of THC did you ingest. They're like, I don't know. Somebody put this in this thingy and told me to breathe in. There's no way that they know. The newer dispensaries, they have better, more accurate dosing, and there is some state regulation to make it more standardized. And also the edibles have a much, like they say, this is exactly this much. So it's like exactly a 15 milligram, which is the effective dose of 15 milligram. It's really common that they'll be dosed in that much. Yeah, what's up?
Just out of curiosity, when was this
This study actually was looked at, I think, in 2003 is when they were looking at. And you make a good point. Yeah. No. So actually, I think I have another spot of that. You know how they always talk about how the drugs are just getting stronger these days. So, all right. Here's where it's not false. I'll get to it in one sec, Russ. So, marijuana, there's been a couple case studies of marijuana precipitating myocardial infarction. If you read the case study, it's from a person who had horrible coronary artery disease and a long-standing hypertension, and their transient hypertension that they got when they were smoking most likely induced their MI. Anyway, the thing that I found was that the average marijuana cigarette in 1970 had 10 milligrams of THC present in it. Today, it's between 50 and 150 milligrams of THC, and that's in the same volume. That's not like the kids aren't just rolling bigger blunts. It's that it's actually just more concentrated. So, yeah.
Are you seeing more like the THC oil, the concentrated THC oils, and like the
dabs?
The honey.
The dabs. Yeah. The dab. So the dab is somebody told me out there what the dab. It's a wax or an oil that's like super concentrated. Yeah. And the dabs, I'm trying to remember what these guys were telling me anecdotally. They were like, people shouldn't like dab for their first try because it's so concentrated. It's mostly for chronic users that have just like toasted their endocannabinoid receptors and have to have like extremely concentrated doses. But again, if we're talking about how it has a transient rise in high blood pressure, and you have someone that's like, I dabbed for the first time, that's something to take note, because they probably got 100-fold of what they, or more of what they originally intended to take. So, the mechanism, this is kind of boring, we don't need to get into all of this stuff. This is interesting. So the endocannabinoid receptor is where it works at. there are some interesting derivatives of THC that have antagonistic effects that don't actually cause that high euphoric effect. They act similarly on the receptor, but in a different mechanism, and they can be used for seizure control. Primarily, I don't know if you guys have seen, there's some videos now of dogs being used. It's being used in dogs for seizures. Interestingly, though, THC does lower seizure threshold. So again, this is like, plus you have to like weigh the pros and cons. So this is that person that's like, pot just cured all my seizures. It's a derivative that's a cannabinoid receptor that acts differently, but the THC will have a similar effect as well. All right, nitrous oxide. Does anybody know what on the top, what that is? It's a whipped cream canister. Oh my God, everybody and their mom at Burning Man has one of these wrapped around in a lasso. This is, I swear to God. So you see these little containers here, this is what they do. It's called Whip It or Laughing Gas. And so they fill the canister with like 4 or 5 of these, and you see them walking around, they're stumbling, and it's like clankety clank 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 as they're stumbling around. And they'll trip and fall, and a bunch of them will roll out of there. It's really funny. But so they use this whipped cream canister is like the only like legally like way that you can obtain it is you say, oh, I'm just using whipped cream canister. You go into any head shop, they sell the whipped cream canister, and they sell whippets by the 100,000s. You can buy them. It's insane. So, also you see people walking around with the stack of balloons, and then you see them tear one open and. And then they get this really deep voice for about 30 seconds, and then their eyes roll back into their head for about 2 minutes, and then they start laughing, and then they're totally fine. It lasts about 5 minutes. Really, really interesting. Super easy to obtain. You can also buy whipped cream just in the store, and make sure you don't tilt it down or the whipped cream will come out. You tilt it up and then the gas comes straight out. There's this stuff that you heard everybody say, like, oh, I don't do too many whippets because they kill your brain cells. Nitrous oxide's really safe for your brain cells. It's used in anesthetic all the time. What's probably happening is that chronic whippet users are repeatedly asphyxiated from... And so that's causing this neuronal death.
Carl asked that I mention that one of the long-term complications that have been presented in a few case studies is acute B12 deficiency from inactivating your serum B12 that can actually present as ascending paralysis. So ask all of your Guillain-Barré patients if they've been doing whippets.
So clinical presentation, you guys will never see this because unless they literally do it in the waiting room and start complaining of it, because it lasts literally less than 5 minutes. So they have to keep do it over and over and over again. This is kind of some jargon, though, about how pneumothorax is not common, but it's a known complication of it. You guys remember how you're supposed to give low-flow oxygen for pneumothorax, for less than 10% pneumothorax because of the nitrogen diffusion? That's why these are prone to causing pneumothorax, because of their increase in nitrogen, partial pressure of nitrogen in the lungs. So, all right. That's my favorite thing, seeing those people just clankety clank clank clank. Great. Benzodiazepines. I'm running short on time, so I'm gonna just. We kind of know benzodiazepines. All I really wanted to talk about with this was you can use Narcan for benzo overdose if you suspect co-ingestion, because you never really know. And then flumazenil. Who's given flumazenil? All right. I gave it once, but I didn't give it. Frank Walter gave it. Flumazenil, controversial in the medical literature. People who are chronic opioid users, given flumazenil can absolutely precipitate seizures. If you have a very good history, you know that this person's like, this is the first time I've ever used this drug, I just tried it and someone gave me too much, and now they're going respiratory depression, you can give it. If you give it, though, it's not like Narcan to where you can give a dose of it and wait and see and maybe give another. If you give flumazenil and you have a response, instant they're going to get a drip and they're going to admit it to the ICU. That's the half-life of flumazenil is way short, and the half-life of benzos is much, much, much longer. Also with any of these ones that have respiratory depression, consider intubation and airway protection if need be. All right. So now, hallucinogens, psychedelics, yeah. These are, I love these terms, intactogen, which means to touch within, which means, it just means that tactile stimulation feels real good, man, that's all. You see, these patients, they're the ones that are rubbing themselves on the bed, physically stimulating themselves, with complete disregard to social connotation. So there's two categories of hallucinogens. There's these indoltryptamine kinds, which is LSD, mushrooms, and DMT, and then phenylethylamines, which is mescaline and MDMA. So we're going to kind of fly through these here. All right. So LSD is lysergic acid. Oral ingestion is the most common. These actually act on receptors that are closely related to schizophrenia. So if it makes sense, schizophrenics have lots of hallucinations. LSD, people take to actually hallucinate. Effects 15 minutes, 30 minutes after ingestion. Duration of action is up to 12 hours. So you definitely could see this in your department, someone having a bad trip. The psychedelic effects, this is a whole host of things that can happen. The synesthesia is kind of the most interesting one to me. People would say that they would see sounds, seeing sounds or feeling colors, particularly seeing... seeing sounds was the one that most people that I heard this year were complaining of. So they'd say, like, when the music would play, they could, like, see colors coming out of the speakers. So they had, like, synesthesia. The trails moving behind objects, like when you messed your mouse settings up and that trail went around the mouse, it's like that, where everything follows it. All right. And they can have a range of effects. So they can have a super good trip and be totally connected, or they can have a complete depersonalization and not remember who they are and feel like their trip's never going to end and that this is my life now. Clinical presentation induces, you know, it includes a lot of these things that you'll see that are cross with the other recreational ones. But this ergotism, this is kind of unique to LSD due to this amide that's present. They call it St. Anthony's fire. You get vasoconstriction causing ischemic pain in your limbs. There's been cases where they've had to actually have vascular surgery involved to open up certain areas to dilate. So. All right, shrooms, dude. So shrooms come in two flavors. There's psilocybin and then this ibotic acid with muscimol in it. As you can see, it says here, the ibotic acid is the glutamic acid analog, so it agonizes the glutamate receptor, and then the muscimol agonizes the GABA receptor. Again, 6 to 12 hours. Man, you'd run into some people out there, you'd need to just have them sit down and be like, what do you need right now? They were tripping balls. With mushrooms, you got to keep in mind that mushrooms are... What do they always tell you about go picking mushrooms? You know, it's super dangerous, right, to go pick mushrooms and eat them. So you're going to trust your drug dealer that they picked the right mushrooms, right? Yeah, good idea. With this, the GI symptoms, super important. If they have immediate GI upset, probably not too bad. But if the GI symptoms happen like 5 to 6 hours later, you're talking like the aflatoxins and things that they've ingested, and now they're going to be in fulminant liver failure and renal failure. So actually having symptoms occur immediately is much better for this kind of thing. Typical hallucinogen profile, though. Oh, come on. Gotta get through this. DMT. Who's heard of DMT before? A couple people? Okay. The spirit molecule. Colloquially, what this was told to me when I asked, oh, what is it? They're like, oh, this is this is the thing that your brain releases from the pineal gland. They know these weird terms. The pineal gland, and that's what your brain releases right before you die, bro. Okay, cool. All right. So apparently you have a flashback of all the pleasant experiences that happened in your life, just like your life would flash before your eyes before you were about to die. This is currently a Schedule 1. DEA actually had trouble getting this because it's used in religious ceremonies. There's a small Christian church actually that used it. In 2006, DEA couldn't get it... couldn't make it illegal, but it has since been made illegal now. So DMT, The effects last 5 to 15 minutes, so you most likely won't see a patient that comes in with this. But where you will see this is in ayahuasca. Who's heard of ayahuasca? Okay, so ayahuasca is DMT that has an MAOI added into it. And this is actually a naturally occurring MAOI that happens. And so this can last up to 12 hours. And this is, I saw somebody in Panama on an ayahuasca trip. Whew, they did not look comfortable. It was nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. They were extremely dehydrated. It didn't look fun at all. I don't know why anybody would ever want to do that. But I think ayahuasca, you might see it, it's getting more and more popular. You might see it more amongst the hippie spiritual group. SSRIs, though, with ayahuasca, with the MAOI, you can precipitate a serotonin syndrome. So you got to keep an eye out for that. Clinical presentation, we're going to fly through here. All right. Mescaline is just, when you see mescaline, just think about mushrooms. This is the peyote cactus. This is what they what it's derived from. This picture here, so this is a picture of cubism, and this is unique to mescaline, is this geometrization where two objects appear 3D. This is what people on mescaline will draw to try and describe their trip. All right, what are the kids doing these days? So MDMA, this is ones you guys should be aware of. So this is called Molly, and this is the colloquially pure form of ecstasy. The reason that that's said is that when ecstasy first became popular, it was pressed pill, and it was always packaged with something else, but you never really knew what it was that it was packed with. So at Burning Man this year, Tesla was this trademark, some brand maker or whatever, Tesla was the premier. If you didn't have Tesla, ecstasy, you weren't, ugh, get away from me. These were the Trump pills that were popular after Trump's inauguration as well. So that's how people had to deal with that. And hence tactile stimulation. This is, you see these everywhere. This is a head massager. You put this thing on your head and it like makes, supposed to make you like give this tingly sensation. They just see people the head massager all day long. Great. You hear people also claim that this supplementation of 5-HTP reduces this washout effect that it has. No evidence to support that at all. That's completely false.
Again, Carl asked if I would break in and make a comment of something he actually learned from Dang Nguyen's Grand Rounds. So we have two included in this episode. What he wanted to comment is how overhydration of these people using MDMA to prevent dehydration can actually cause a hypervolemic hyponatremia that can lead to seizures. It can cause cerebral edema requiring mannitol or hypertonic saline. And he wanted to add this because even though MDMA does not directly lower your seizure threshold, it can indirectly cause seizures from a psychogenic polydipsia. Great medical word, not used often enough.
All right, so MDMA is called Molly, and this, if you'll see, this is the form that has methamphetamine derivative in it. All right, now, MDA is the one with just amphetamine derivative. So now, MDMA is metabolized to MDA in your body, and it's excreted in the urine unchanged. So, if you use MDMA and you drink your pee, you'll be high again with your MDA. So this is actually interesting because the MDA has a faster onset but shorter duration. MDMA takes longer to take effect but lasts longer. So now the kids have white Heineken pills. These names, I don't know where they find them. Which has both in it. So you get it super fast and it lasts a long time. So, awesome possible. Ketamine, we all know all about ketamine. This is our favorite drug. So is it vegan? I don't know. Clinical presentation of ketamine. Sorry, I'm firing through here because we're. Ketamine, you know, benzos can be used for the dissociative effect that they have. I saw when I worked in the medic tent. Colin and I actually both volunteered as students at Burning Man when we were med students. You'd get people that had a low quality ketamine that was cut. And they wanted to just try a little bit just to see what it was like. And they were subtherapeutic and they were in that really nasty dissociative period. The treatment is more ketamine. So they'd come into the medic tent and they'd just get them really, really high. And then they'd send them on out after a couple hours of observation. It was great. Saving lives. Oh, one thing I wanted to mention, ketamine laryngospasm, common side effect of it, probably not going to happen from orally ingesting or snorting, but from injecting can. The initial treatment for that is to get a good seal and try and bag valve ventilate and break that laryngospasm. You can also use paralytics in worse cases. Something to remember since we give ketamine a lot. Ecstasy, like I said, this is just the retro name for MDMA. So retro. All right, approach to treatment. I could just put this one slide that says benzos, but that's, as usual with tox, you know, we don't, as Robert French would say, all tox is bull. So poison control, you can call to report these things. It helps the data collection, and they can also offer some insights. So these are things that you want to look for on your physical exam, because these drugs can precipitate other underlying things like serotonin syndrome and tachycardia and such. What to order? Your typical tox workup, but make sure that your, you know, ABCs, air IVO2 monitor, end-tidal CO2, finger stick glucose, because nobody wants to be that person that says, oh, they're just narked out of their mind and their blood sugar's 12. Depending on the situation, troponins, if they're complaining of chest pain, if you're suspecting co-ingestion. Tylenol and salicylates are probably good to get on everybody, because they might not have intentionally ingested it, but their stuff may have been cut with something cheaper like Tylenol or a salicylate, so they may have ingested it unknowingly. A CK, if they look like they've been dehydrated, some of these meth users typically will use for 72 hours at a time. Oh, hey, look, troponin's on there twice. It must be important. Chest x-ray is also good because the inhaled substance can cause irritation. You can also get pneumothorax, as we discussed from previous ones, previous slides. All right. Is there another? Yeah, also important to do primary-secondary survey on these people, because they are not reliable historians. Correct the vital sign abnormalities. That's basically what supportive care is correct the vital sign abnormalities. So you can see here, the prescription opioids are by far the premier. This is what all the cool kids are doing now. So these are the deaths, per number of deaths in the U.S., and from the year, and they're just going rising. Like I said, cannabis, probably the lowest one, but definitely still has an effect there. So I have some photos from my research at Burning Man. So this is a collection of photos from my years 2014 and then my most recent year this year. So this is, so you call, so guys may have seen in Colin's slide, this is what the Burning Man Festival looks like. So there's about 70, 75,000 people. This is the third biggest city in Nevada when it's actually running. So how this works is all the radians are a time. So this one here is 6 o'clock, you have 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock. And then each concentric circle is a letter. So, like this is 6 o'clock, and then this would be, this one's actually Esplanade, but this is A, B, C, and D. So you tell somebody, oh, I'm at 6 o'clock in D, and you know right where this person is. It's pretty cool how you can figure out how to get around out there. In the middle, very center, is the giant man, and then in that big empty circle, there's all of this just craziness happening. This is the medic tent that's out there. It's actually like a legitimate, they call it a hospital. It looks like a hospital. This is the triage area. These are some pictures from when I was a student there. They gave me this sweet scrub top. It says medic student on it. So these are like more critical patients that were in the back. That's Carl with baby beard. It's actually interesting because it's a giant desert and people don't understand that you actually have like full ambulance, like medical capability out there, which is pretty cool.
You get to do your own x-rays.
Yeah, they have their x-ray capability and ultrasound as well. So it's pretty cool. I remember one of my favorite stories. We had one lady that showed up Monday complaining of right lower quadrant pain, really classic for appy. Ultrasounded her with a little pocket one. She had some free fluid, and they were like, oh, you're going to have to go back to Reno. And so she went back to Reno. She checked into Renown, to the hospital, got diagnosed with appendicitis. She had her appendix out on Tuesday. She recovered, discharged Thursday afternoon, back on the playa on Friday.
No.
She came to see us for a dressing change, and she brought us some brownies, which you have to be careful of when someone offers you brownies. So these are just this is what's basically happening in the center is these cool art cars and stuff, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. Like, so this squid is El Pupo. He was retired last year, actually. Now they have Rancid Transport is his replacement. It's a giant goat head that shoots flames from it with a fish on the other side. I couldn't get a picture because I only have videos of it, so I couldn't get a picture up there. But that's what's there now. This is the Thunderdome. So many patients from the Thunderdome. Geodesic dome where they hang people from bungee cords and swing them at each other and they beat the crap out of each other. This is where, as a medical student, Colin and I both learned to repair lacerations, because there's a line of people from this that just need to be sewn up. Oh, great. So this is from this year. Someone gave me that parasol because they said I looked fair-skinned and needed a parasol, so I was protected from it. Our gift to the playa, my camp's gift, was coffee, so there's this hipster making pour-over coffee here. So the key to survive Burning Man is you need a cup with a photocopy of your ID on it, because everywhere you go will give you free alcohol as long as you have an ID. And this was my group of rowdy campers. And it's a dirty, stinky, great fun time. All right.